Good evening, and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program. I'm your host, David Katzmeier, coming to you this December 13th, 2012. We have a very special interview tonight with Molly Cheshire. Molly has worked on many projects in a variety of capacities for more than 20 years. She was on the production team of the Emmy Award-winning NBC documentary, The Mystery of the Sphinx. She was the lighting in the lighting department of major motion pictures such as Philadelphia, True Lies, and 12 Monkeys. She has also worked in the editing department for NBC's coverage of the Olympics in Sydney and Salt Lake City, and their coverage of the tennis championships at Wimbledon and at the French Open. Molly has also operated camera for various documentaries and did lighting for the hit TV show Law and Order. Molly Cheshire has produced and directed the talk show New Realities with Ellen Steinfeld in New York City, her own show, Meetings with Remarkable People, with interviews of on cutting-edge experts in various fields, which airs each week on the Manhattan Neighborhood Network. That's MNN.org. It airs each Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern. As a great-granddaughter of Frank Patterson, who co-founded NCR, she has been researching the Patterson history for years in hopes of producing documentaries to preserve her family's contribution to history. Molly has an innate sense of American history, being a descendant of Arthur Middleton, who signed the Declaration of Independence, and is related to Edward Rutledge, who also signed the Declaration of Independence, as well as John Rutledge, who was the second Chief Justice of the United States and co-signer of the U.S. Constitution. Her forthcoming book, The Saga of the Mali Lama, is a unique work. The saga is a high-octane ride through the spiritual world from the pyramids of Egypt to the Mayan ruins of Mexico to hot springs of Northern California to the ashrams of India and then back home again. Imagine Eat, Pray, Love meets Sex and the City, or else envision Bridget Jones goes to India with Paula, her newfound best friend and spiritual mentor. These girls may take the quest seriously, but not themselves. Throughout their travels, the Mali Lama and St. Paula meet up with some of the leading lights of the New Age, including renegade Egyptologist John Anthony West, John Mack, the controversial Harvard physicist.
Psychiatrist,
thank you, known for his investigation of alien abduction, and Ramtha, the Enlightened One, who is the channeled sage featured in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? Introductory free chapters of her book will be available for download later this month on her website at themalilama.com. Tonight, we're going to discuss one woman's saga in discovering and reconciling her heritage in the legacy of American history as we all inherit in order to find her place in a changing world, an important thing to do in the cycles of time. How do we reconcile the cycles from which we come, understand where we are, find our place in it, and look forward. Molly, welcome to the show tonight.
It's great to be here.
Indeed. Molly, you're currently working on projects in Philadelphia right now.
Yes, actually I'm working on an update of Robert Louis Stevenson's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde called Do No Harm, which refers to the Hippocratic Oath of Do No Harm. And this guy from Rescue Me, Stephen Pasquale, he plays a neurosurgeon who at night his alter ego comes out and wreaks havoc, and how he reconciles his good side with his bad side. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's something we have to do. The divided self, our id impulses, our superego restraints, we see it within ourselves individually. We also see it played out through history. And so what you see in a fractal relationship between the inner workings of a person, we can also see over time in a nation. As you work on the entertainment world of bringing things forth, you're on the inside presenting what we see on the surface when we go and look at something on the screen. And at the same time, you have a very rich inheritance of history. Your family has just been here for centuries.
Well, I mean, America's so young, it's hard to take. I mean, once you've seen Egypt, you really start to see how heritage is, you know, can go back millennia. And the what's interesting to me about the Egyptian culture is that it seems to have started at a very high peak and then devolved from there. Because, like, for example, the Old Kingdom structures are all these massive, huge stones, and then the Middle Kingdom are smaller stones, and then the New Kingdom are even smaller. So yeah. You go from this very high place, and then over thousands of years, you know, I mean, I guess they lasted for, what, 3,000 or 4,000 years before it ended up the way it is today?
And that is a lesson to us that history does not move in a linear progression. It has its ups and downs.
Right.
And so we just can't expect everything to go forward in a straight line. And there are peaks that have come before we are now, and we are finding the remnants of it. Then we find a decline, some rises and falls and so forth, hence the cycles.
Well, you were saying that in 1775, when is, you know, you've pinpointed as the birth
of the United States.
Of the United States. It was on an upswing of all three. I mean, explain what you were talking about.
Well, it's basically the biorhythms of the United States is the theory that I put forth and what I call calorhythms. You can find more about that at calorhythms, K-A-L-A-rhythms.org, where these are just basically the biorhythms of the United States, believing that you can think of a country as if it were a person. And it has a physical cycle, an emotional cycle, and an intellectual cycle that rise and fall, influencing our societies in different ways. And these rises and fall take tens of years to go through their cycles.
But on your website, it shows that it's on an upswing. Does everything when it starts, does that always
Yes.
start up?
Where does a cycle begin? Where do you begin a circle? And it turns out that we found that the cycles, the rhythms of life, begin in the middle. They're not at the peak, and they're not at the trough. They're at the midpoint. And from there, they all rise to their peak and then go down and up. But when you have more than one cycle, and the different cycles are of different durations, what happens is you get a myriad of patterns of highs and lows as you go through time, hence our changing times in America. So yes, they start.
So the biorhythms divided into emotional, intellectual, and physical. Mm-hmm. How many years for the country does each go through? You know, like
yeah, you can count from 1775 when we began in the Revolutionary War and find a physical cycle of 28 years,
right?
An emotional cycle of 36 years, and an intellectual cycle of 44 years.
I mean, what's interesting to me is, you know, I sort of blame myself or my family for starting the Civil War, because when all these guys were signing the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, they insisted on including slavery as a tenet of our Constitution, which is just so reprehensible. It's I just can't even believe that it was allowed, but without the Southern support, they wouldn't have had the unity in order to go against the British. But so where does that play out in 1861 when the Civil War finally happened?
The outbreak of the war began in 1859 at Browns Ferry, you know, which is
right.
Now West Virginia. And that was an upward crossover crisis in the 28-year physical cycle. When you mentioned that slavery was allowed in the early beginning, something that was corrected many years later, to understand that, we'd have to take a look at an even greater set of cycles than the ones we just mentioned. Because all countries with the cycles like we have live under the umbrella of world rhythms that last not tens of years, but hundreds of years.
Right.
And the last couple hundred years or so was a time in which the world physical cycle had this great physical high that gave us the Industrial Revolution, that's physical, and the Machine Age, that's physical. But unfortunately, both the world emotional cycle, centuries-long cycle, and the intellectual cycle both bottomed out in the late 1800s. What I mean is that the world, we kind of coming out of an era when the physical was high, the emotional, intellectual was low, we outbuilt our own sense and didn't care. That's physical high,
but
emotional, intellectual
low. But that explains
low.
More the Industrial Revolution. Let's go back 40 years to the Civil War and what was going on at that time in the world cycle.
In the world cycle, that was, since these things are so slow moving and these cycles last for hundreds of years, that's pretty much the position
Same
that they
position.
Were in.
Mm-hmm. So that's what allowed
inhumanity. force. You know, materialism is a result of a physical cycle, and that comes with the physical high. And this is why we have the Industrial Revolution and the mechanized world and material advancements and a lot of miracles and a lot of wonderful things that have happened. But unfortunately, when the emotional cycle was low, people have blind ambition without compassion. And that's physical high, emotional, intellectual low. And blind ambition without compassion means that there'll be abusive usury of others in order to get one's own material gain. So anyway, that's an overview of the cycles of where we come. And, you know, I enjoy discussing this with you, Molly, because you have such a rich history in this. I know you had a general in your family.
Right. We didn't mention my grandfather.
Yeah.
He was a head of the 10th Air Force in China, Bourbon, and India. And basically, he was, I think, one of the first 100 flyers. I mean, that may be an overstatement. But he went after Pancho Villa before the First World War, and then he was in the First World War, and then in the Second World War. But he knew all these guys, like Eddie Rickenbacker, who was sort of the Baron von, Richthofen. Mm-hmm. You know, the World War I flying ace.
Yes.
And Billy Mitchell, who basically created the Air Force, was a good friend of his, too. And Lindbergh, he almost set the Spirit of St. Louis on fire because they were towing it back to the Smithsonian. And the wheels on the plane, well, what happened is they broke the wings off, and they were trailering it back, but they didn't have it on a trailer. They were literally dragging it on the actual wheels. And so they kept catching on fire.
Oh,
so they
Lord.
Would have to stop every once in a while. And they were doing this in the middle of the night because they didn't want to deal with a bunch of traffic. So there they were driving down, I guess, Route 1 or something, because that's the only thing they had back in those days. And the wheels kept catching on fire. And so it almost, we almost didn't have the Spirit of St. Louis.
Oh, good Lord.
In the Smithsonian, because, I mean, luckily we do, but I always think that's pretty hilarious.
So many tales of American history that are only known to a few, some are known to the many, but in fact, everything in our experience, our collective consciousness, is inherited by us all. And so how, even if you have only just moved to this country, or if you've had a family that's been here for hundreds of years, I believe that what you're inheriting is not only the common future of a country, as all countries will have it,
right,
but you're inheriting all the thoughts, actions, and feelings that have gone into that country's history. You have inherited the spirit of America.
Well, and I think kind of what's different about my family, since they were well documented, I have a sense of who they were versus most people, you know, their families aren't well documented except from word of mouth through individual. But I can go to public resources, and luckily John H. Patterson, who was my great-grandfather's brother who started National Cash Register, did a book about his grandfathers, who one was friends with Daniel Boone and founded Lexington, Kentucky.
Indeed.
And was a great Indian fighter, which is sort of an ignominious term, I think.
Quite so.
And then his other grandfather was a great Indian agent just north of Dayton. And he was actually the nice guy and really kept to his fair dealings with the Indians. And the Indians liked him and was much more of a peacemaker. And so I'm more interested in his history just because what we did to the Indians is also outrageous. You know, I mean, we basically stole all their land.
Well, we started out talking about what you're doing in Philadelphia right now in a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde
right.
sort of scenario.
Exactly.
And when you look inside of any country, you're going to find, you know, a little bit of angel and a little bit of devil. What's really amazing about the United States and our history is that we have a self-correcting nature. And
right.
we have had, you know, we have gone from abuse to freedom. We have corrected a lot of things. We've had to reconcile that. And it's interesting, that's happening now as the physical cycle that was high before, well, that isn't high anymore. It's going down, declining, as we're moving away from blind ambition to let's go green, and the emotional cycle is rising.
Really? I thought you said everything was plummeting. I mean, go back to 2012.
Well, now, if you look in the cycles of the United States only, and you look at the small moving cycles that last tens of years, this is a decade when the biorhythms of the United States, the colorhythms of the United States are declining. But fret not, that's a temporal thing. They bottom out, rise again. You will see these cycles rise and fall in your lifetime.
This looks like a place of abuse here at sort of 2040 or 2035.
Are you looking?
The emotional cycle is low, and the physical and
In the 2030s, emotional cycle will be high.
No, it's high. It's the intellectual cycle that's low.
You know what's interesting about the 2030s? You can see this, folks, on kalarhythms.org, kalarhythms.org. Both the physical cycle and the emotional cycle will be high at the same time in the United States. Now, the physical cycle being high will bring improvements to industry. And the emotional cycle being high at the same time means compassion and humanity. Now, Molly, we were talking earlier before.
But wait, what does it mean when the intellectual cycle is low? Does that mean
we're not as bright? We're not as inventive, right? We're not going to be as creative at that time. But this is what we.
That's not too bad, though.
Well, in the 1890s, we had a very similar configuration because. In that decade, as in the coming 2030s, both the physical cycle and the emotional cycle peaked while the intellectual cycle hit the bottom.
Which is when NCR was created. And what I love about NCR is that all of the fringe benefits that we enjoy today was not primarily, but John H. Patterson spearheaded reforms to the workplace. Because the workers were sabotaging the cash registers, so he decided that if he improved working conditions and gave people recognition for what they did, that they would give more productivity. Indeed. And his attitude was, when all the other robber baron industrialists were criticizing him because they didn't want to have to do the same thing for their workforce, he said, it doesn't cost, it pays.
Yes.
So that if you can financially incentivize corporations to do the right thing by their workers, it's a win-win situation for all. And there's a great article that the Smithsonian Magazine did on John H. and the whole NCR model. And what I think would be interesting is to do a documentary to show this model, and because I feel like corporations are being demonized nowadays, you know, with the whole Occupy Wall Street thing. But it's not really the corporations that are bad. It's the misguided executives that think that they're going to get the most out of their bottom line by not treating people right. I mean, I just saw an interesting graphic on Costco versus Walmart. Costco treats people well and actually outperforms Walmart. You know, the Sam's Club part of Walmart, not Walmart per se. And so it just goes to show that you can hire union people and pay people a decent wage and not outsource everything and still have a very healthy bottom line so that your investors are happy and your workers are happy. And I don't know if the executives are happy, but you would think that they're not going to shortchange themselves.
And here you see a trend. I mean, we're moving out of the dark era of slavery. We're moving out of the sweatshops for those who weren't considered slaves but were being taken advantage of.
I disagree. I think that we're just shifting it because China was cheap labor, and now China's gotten too expensive, and now we're going to Vietnam and I don't know what other poorer countries that we're exploiting, but I'm sure there's just, you know, Africa, once again, is just waiting there to be, you know, exploited. But the thing is that I don't think it has to be that way. I think that by buying products that are basically built by wage slaves, it's no different.
No, and will we learn the lessons of the past? Are we moving out of that instead of just shifting it from one place where it is visible to another place where it is not apparent to the consumer? Will the consumers have the conscientious mind to be selective? Because that's where the power comes in an industrialized society. The power lies with the consumer. And so I do believe that there is more effort and more concern to be selective on whether something is green or compassionate.
Well, I mean, for example, Walmart used to base everything they said built in the USA. And it turns out that that was just a total sham. And they were taking labels off that sort of said made in China and putting in other labels, you know.
Interesting. And I mean, if it's assembled here, the components themselves may have come from somewhere else.
You know, I mean, like, for example, my VW Beetle was assembled in Mexico because probably the German workers were too expensive. And all you have to do is to have some kind of oversight that is get the quality control up, and then you can exploit third world sweatshops, basically.
Indeed, and that's one of the aspects of the physical cycle not being as high as it was. The boundaries come down. Walls go up on a physical high. They come down on a physical low. So hence, we're becoming less nationalistic, and trade and economics and commerce is more international. The world is flat in a physical low. But the emergence of the emotional high and the intellectual high into the high half, coming out of the repressive Victorian era, right, from which we come, and the intellectual low of the past couple of centuries is just breaking through right now. From 2000 to 2012, we're in a crisis transitional period in which these two great cycles lasting hundreds of years are breaking through to give us a reverse of what we come from, in that the emotional and the intellectual cycles of the world will be high throughout this century and all of the next century and more beyond that, and the physical cycle will be low. So what does that mean? We're going to find new ways to clean up the industrial mess of the previous physical high.
I mean, for example, my father, who used to be an evil chemist for DuPont, he now is working on free energy based on an old Tesla model. And so, you know, that is going to really revolutionize the entire world, because, I mean, for example, everybody's always complaining about taxation and all this other stuff, and we are wholesale shipping money offshore, forget about China, to the Middle East to buy petroleum products that we shouldn't really be using anyway. I mean, as Dad said, it's sort of like heating your house by chopping up all your furniture and throwing it into the fireplace. I mean, yes, there's so many better things that can be used, that petrochemicals should be used for. I mean, plastics being one of them, but plastics are sort of annoying too, because, I mean, he was on the team that helped invent the plastic Coke bottle, which we thought was just a terrible idea. I mean, I remember the days of, you know, when you could, they had bottle washing plants.
Yeah.
And they had those beautiful Coke bottles, and then, you know, they were deposit, and you had, and then there was no deposit, no return, which was sort of cheap glass, which I thought was a terrible idea. And, I mean, I was a kid, but Mom and I were just like, oh, my God. And then he brought home the prototype for the plastic Coke bottle.
Yeah.
And we thought, oh, God, this is even worse. Now they're just going to be throwing all this plastic into the landfills, which, I mean, yes, there is recycling, but it'd be so much better if all the sodas weren't just encased in aluminum or plastic.
Yeah, and we're seeking alternatives to the ways that of just a throwaway society. The president has mandated that there be stricter performances on the gas mileage of cars and everything like that, and that we find alternative energies by 2015.
So. Yes, but he's, I mean, let me put it this way. Dad worked at Oak Ridge on the nuclear alternative, shall we say, and I can't remember how much of the GDP we devoted to you know, the atomic bomb or atomic energy. But if we put that kind of force behind really looking for alternative energy, then we probably could find it. Now he's working with this inventor in some garage in Augusta, Georgia, you know, and that is just not the way to be at the forefront of these new energies. And the interests of the, you know, oil and gas and all these technologies that we have in place that are finite are so pervasive that it's very difficult to get anything else going. Even solar. I mean, the idea that we used to have solar panels in the White House and Reagan took them off, I mean, that is just such a sad state of affairs. I mean, Germany, which is not known for its solar, you know, sun, they run I can't remember how much energy they produce, but it's a phenomenal amount just through solar.
Yeah, but in the long term, solar is prevailing. I think it's Drexel University in Philadelphia that has their library as a model for solar energy. And I mean, it gets very hot outside. They cool the library down at night, and during the day, the books themselves keep the library cool. And then they use the solar for heating in the wintertime. And so it may be a contest between old world and new world, but I believe that where we are in the cycles of time, getting off the bloodline of our economy, oil, is something that will ultimately prevail, and it's happening now in some parts.
I mean, I don't doubt it, but I'm just saying that it's unfortunate. See, what I want to know is why in the cycles of history are we so resistant to the new technologies? I mean, how in your graphs does that corroborate what's actually happening?
Being resistant to new technologies is, I believe, where we're coming from. And, you know, holding on to the old oil, holding on to the, you know, the mega corporations and everything like that is the old paradigm. You know, this is something of the sunset companies, of the old hierarchy of power of dominance and using our resources as only a means for, you know, ambition.
So in the thousand-year cycle, it's the fact that the physical is coming down, sort of starting at the...
Well, an interesting time. It crossed out of the high that gave us our Industrial Revolution.
Right.
It crossed down in 1978, giving us a 12-year period of crisis as it broke down into the low half. During 1978, what did we see as signs of castles crumbling, ending the physical high? Well, we had the siege of the embassy.
Was that when the oil embargo was?
The oil embargo actually began in the double crossover of the United States. And so that was already happening as of 1973. But the Shah of Iran subsequently fell.
Right, 79.
And you had the Iranian hostage crisis in 79. And you also had a siege in Pakistan of, and during that time, between 1978 and 1990, you had the Berlin Wall fall.
Right.
And you had the Tiananmen Square incident in China, where
right.
an individual stood up against a tank and the individual won. And that is a intellectual rising against physical declining. So when the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union collapsed, you could see that the end of an era was in
I don't
play.
Know if it collapsed, it converted.
It did convert into the CIS, but the nation as it was no longer
well,
is there.
True.
Provinces succeeded, became independent states. And so really that is a classic example of people trying to hold on to the old paradigm. And what happened, Russia was like iron, and iron is very strong but also very brittle. And so when they were resistant to the change and they tried to hold on to the past, they became part of the past. And crumbled.
Right.
So the important thing, the lesson for the United States and all nations around the world is that we now have to be adaptive and transformative to break away from the old machine age into the new era of technology.
So how do you think that we can contribute in this day and age to making the United States, you know, better? I mean, how do we surf the wave?
I would go back to how can you and I do it as individuals?
Right, that's
well,
what I mean.
We are the many as consumers, and I would say be selective in what you buy and actually look, is something green? Is something not being produced where it's being produced with slave labor? Is it something? Look for alternatives in your own home. Be willing to spend a little bit more if you can to have alternative energies.
Or you don't even have to spend more. I mean, like, for example, I have a little garden outside.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody's saying that, you know, organic produce is too expensive to buy. Well, and also organic doesn't always mean really organic. You know, if it, you know, like someone was looking at my collard greens and it has holes in the leaves and they're like, well, I mean, that's not the way it is at the organic, you know, Whole Foods. I said, well, I bet those things aren't as organic. They must be putting pesticides on them.
Because stand the reason.
There are, I mean, they say it's by companion planting or all kinds of things, but I have yet to produce, you know, produce that is completely without chop marks from various insects.
Yeah, the definition you have to worry about, at free-range chickens, for instance, if chickens are cooped up and allowed to run at any time of the day before they're put back in the coops. They're free range.
I know.
So,
but I'm just saying that, but just by having a little victory garden is, to me, a way to have organic produce at my fingertips, you know, summer and winter. There's a lot of winter crops that I have planted. And at really a minimal cost. I mean, I only have an eighth of an acre here in the little village of Unionville.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you don't have to have a huge piece of land. You know, most people live, I don't know about suburbia, but most people have about an acre of land or less. You know, I mean, everybody lives in the city, allegedly, except they don't. Well, there was the white flight from the cities,
mm-hmm.
you know, in particular, you know, so that, you know, a lot of people of means moved out, and that's what's destroying all the cities, you know, is because the tax base was taken away.
tax base was taken away. Taxes increased for those who remained because they were trying to make up for the difference. And you're having demographic shifts for all different reasons. And not only was there a flight from the cities, Philadelphia is a good example of that, if you look in the past 30 years, but also some of the major corporations were moving out of the city. General Electric moved out in the 1980s. Many others moved out. So there was a white flight. There was a corporate flight. And we're seeing a decentralization, but this is also part of the physical cycle coming down. The centralization of businesses into a corner market becomes a supermarket. A shop that produces items becomes part of mass production. You have row homes that are centered around these gigantic factories that are producing standard products. It was all part of the conformity of the machine age. All of that is ending now, and we're doing microbreweries, microprocessing, micropublishing, micro this and micro that, and it's also becoming more localized, regionalized and localized instead of standardized and nationalized, while at the same time national boundaries come down.
And the internet has facilitated that.
Sure has.
I can't think of any other one thing that has revolutionized the whole micro everything.
Absolutely.
But also, even if you live in the city, there are community gardens. You know, my cousin used to manage one in D.C. And so that it's interesting that you still can grow your own vegetables, even in a house in containers, you know, and be assured that you know exactly what you're growing and putting on it and putting into your body.
Yes. And as we become more prosumer versus consumer, that's another move away.
What do you mean prosumer?
Prosumer is doing for yourself rather than going out and working your job on a specialized product that is sold to someone else.
Right.
So you're not making your own clothes. You're not growing your own food. You're going to the factory and making those widgets. But then when it comes time that you have to have the food and the items in your house or that piece of hardware to fix your door, you go and buy them at a store because someone else is working a job specializing on making those hinges that you need. And
you can consumer. Make your own parts.
And you can. And more people are becoming a little bit centric in their lives and becoming prosumers versus consumers. Consumers is part of the machine age era.
Right.
So with the rise of the internet that you mentioned, that is showing how the intellectual high that we're breaking into is transcending and superseding the boundaries from which we come. But you understand so deeply the world from which we come because your family has been here for hundreds of years, and I think that you have an innate understanding because what happens is the consciousness of a people is something that Oswald Spengler has spoken about, Giovanni Bautista has talked about. These great philosophers pointed out that there's a character of a people, and whether you're new to this country or whether you're part of a family that's been here for a long time, you inherit that and you become part of that.
Right.
And it's a collective consciousness.
But once again, I think that one of the reasons why I'm so aware of my place in American history is that since these figures were documented and I can read the documents and there are books written about them and, you know, there's a lot of information out there, so I understand what their part is. And then there's family lore that goes along with it, which, of course, I find out there was a pack of lies. I mean, there's all these legends that were passed down. And when I actually went back to try to corroborate a lot of this stuff.
You mean Paul Bunyan wasn't real?
No, it's not even that. It's just that our family has stories about these people, these figures in our ancestry. And when you actually go back to corroborate with the evidence, it doesn't jive. Mm. And I can't remember any examples at this point, but I know that as a historian, I like to go back to the, what do they call it, the first documents or the original documentation. I can't remember. Best evidence. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But, you know, to look at people's letters. And like, for example, all the Civil War letters are still intact. You know, yeah. My great-great-whatever grandmother, they had four sons in the Civil War, and John H. was the youngest. He ended up starting NCR on the family property. But the other three sons, one of which died soon after, and one was the eldest, and he had the highest position. But it's fascinating to go back. You can actually read the letters of their experience and their parents' letters back to them. Well, actually, most of those are gone because soldiers, it was very difficult for them to archive stuff because, you know, you're tromping around
in
the mud.
Weeks at a time.
And but they had a couple of letters from the parents to the kids. But once again, it's not that this stuff is not available, but most families, you know, houses get broken up and people forget and they don't tell the stories and they don't pass them down and nobody remembers, and it's the best evidence is not always available.
Yeah, and we can't always rely on historic accounts because history is written by the victors. However, I believe that we inherit a collective consciousness, and you know, you have the inheritance of yourself as an individual. You inherit things through your family line. You inherit things, I believe, through your racial line. William Faulkner spoke about that. And
what did he have to say about it?
Well, he was raised in Mississippi, and as a boy, he was raised by a mammy, is
right.
What it's called. And this was a black woman who worked for the family and, you know, helped raising the children. And he loved her. He loved her dearly as if it were his own mother.
Right.
But he subsequently wrote that he believed that there's such a thing as, he believed in Jung's collective unconscious. And he believed that there was such a thing as a collective unconscious in subsets of the entire humanity, and that you can have a racial collective unconscious. So he believes that everyone of the white race, of the black race, he believed that he observed the collective unconscious that united all members of the black race here in America, which is a very important thing to observe because you have the disenfranchisement of people taken from their homeland and brought here, not speaking their language, not knowing their ancestors, and then basically becoming part of a new nation, a new collective consciousness. And yet, it's very interesting when you look at the songs that have been written and are written today and compare it to some of the songs that you can find in parts of Africa. When you look at the food, the soul food of today, and go into the Caribbean and look at some of the food there, they have their differences, but compare it to the foods that you can find in Africa, there is such a similarity. And I believe that's very true because what I'm essentially talking about in the United States is a collective consciousness of a nation. So there are subfields in Jung's collective unconscious, hence the cycles of a nation.
So how can we maximize these cycles in this particular...
Understanding where we come from to help understanding where we are, because we understand where we are, we can understand where we're
right.
going.
But let's put that in more concrete terms. How can we use what we know in order to move forward in the most advantageous way?
Knowing where the cycles of time are is like a farmer who knows what time of year it is.
I know,
to plant.
But so, come on, get specific. What can we do best now knowing what you know about the cycles?
Get off oil. Yes, absolutely.
Well, I agree. I mean, and as I said, Dad is really moving forward with that. But it's difficult without the support and the consensus. I mean, everybody gives it lip service, but when it comes to actual funding, it seems that...
Move slowly.
Well, and then that whole company, I can't remember, that Obama supported that seemed to be working in the right direction, and then they went bankrupt, and it seemed to set solar or alternative energy back as far as the...
Yeah,
the will of a nation to...
There'll be bumps along the way, and the important thing is that we continue on that. It used to be that we weren't even trying these things before.
We were, but Carter, because of the whole Iranian hostage crisis, he lost the election to Reagan, which was a retrograde step, I think, in a lot of ways. Because I think that Carter was a sort of a undervalued president. I mean, what was going on... why did he have to take a hit for the team, so to speak?
In the 1980 election, where Reagan won very strongly against incumbent President Carter.
I would say a landslide, no?
Yeah, and the 1984 election was also a landslide against Mondale.
Well, but that was a no-brainer. I mean, the Democrats just did not have a valid candidate.
No, and what was happening in the 1980s was the cycles of the United States were reversing from where they were in the 1960s. In the 1980s, you have a physical high with
yeah.
an emotional and intellectual low.
I see.
And during the two terms of President Reagan, we used the physical high and built up the military. And it was often called the Star Wars Project.
Right.
And we increased, you know, our number of ships, tanks, and our presence overseas and so forth. And we would go into little places like Grenada
and basically outspent the Russians and bankrupted
them. That was the strategy.
I mean, forget Star Wars. Star Wars was never going to be a possibility. But what we could do is outspend them. Is put the fear of Star Wars into the mix.
Yes.
And then they would try to keep up with this because they beat us in the space race back in the day with Sputnik.
Yeah.
And
the first
then
man in space.
You can't just devote your entire GNP for I don't know how many years on the military and expect that you're not going to have...
Right. And so there you have physical high with us moving towards military, which is physical, and armaments, which is physical, as opposed to seeking intellectual alternatives during an intellectual low, which is the intellectual cycle bottomed out in 1984.
So once again, so get off oil. What else do you foresee?
We are entering, Molly, into an era of romanticism. It may not be apparent right now, but I believe very strongly that we are.
Romanticism. What does that mean?
That means that... Well,
we're going to be waxing rhapsodic about the good old days?
Well, no, I don't think we're going to be quite as reminiscent emotionally as creating new fields in the arts and in music and just basically our view of life. When you look at some of the music that came out of what was the previous romantic era?
Yeah, Beethoven.
Yes. And
isn't Schubert a romantic?
It could be considered a romantic, you know, and...
Anyway, but so back to the microbrewery approach. I mean, I have a book that's going to be coming out soon, and also a record that is available online, and so it's kind of funny that you mention the romantic era, because I've been poised to get these creations out into the
universe. It's happening later this month. You're going to make some preliminary chapters available of your forthcoming book, The Saga of the Molly Lama,
and St. Paul of Gramercy Park.
Okay.
You forgot the second half.
That's a long title.
It's a long title, and people have been complaining about it. But
Tell me a little bit about this. I mean, we've been going back and forth about cycles of the United States, where are we in the world, and everything like this. But Molly, you are world traveled. I've seen your passport. It's got more stamps than that. And then, you know, they'd have to put new pages in your book.
I almost ran out of pages. And basically in 2000, I thought, you know, I'm really tired of traveling. I'm going to stay home. And I traveled, I think, 9 months out of that year. You know, I worked in Sydney at the Olympics. I went to India. I went to India in 99 for the millennium and stayed until April and traveled around India and Hong Kong, Sri Lanka. And then got a job at the Summer Olympics in Sydney. And then worked at the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake, and also was working at Wimbledon in the French Open during the summertime as well. So, you know, once you're over there, you might as well hang out, you know, and cruise around.
Wonderful that.
So, you know, it was fun.
You're very world travel. To you, cycles of the world means moving around the world.
Well, I just remember moving around the world the wrong way, because the cheapest way to fly from India to America is via Seoul. You know, Korean Air has got the cheapest flight. So I think I flew from Bombay or Mumbai to Seoul and then back to New York from there.
That's a lot of travel.
Which it seems kind of counterintuitive, but it was a difference in price, I think, I don't know, I think one way, a round trip, I think, was $1,200. I don't know. I can't remember what the price was, but that was the cheapest way to go. And then you have a really annoying six-hour layover in Seoul, which you're already extremely exhausted from being on the flight for 12 hours or something. And then you got to get on another flight for another 12 hours. And
wind up in a different time zone or day.
It's just the Walking Dead after a while, you know. And the best thing I found out in Seoul is they have a place that you can get a massage and take a shower. So you get, you know, a shower at least, and then you sort of halfway feel human, and then you get back on a plane, and I didn't have the luxury of having one of those lay-down sort of, you know, business class sleeper things that they have. I got that once. Mm. I got bumped off a flight in Geneva.
And all they had was first class.
Well, let me put it this way. I didn't know I was getting bumped to first class when I got to London, but they kept canceling my flight, and I was so furious that I had to stay in Geneva for an extra couple of days at my expense. And so I get to London, and I'm just in a temper. You know, this is flying from Geneva to London. And I get up there, and they said, oh, they've changed your seat. And I was about to let this woman have it, right? And I thought, no, let me see what the seat is before I freak out. And she had bumped me up to one of these lay-down sort of cocoon type of operations.
Oh, boy.
So it's only a five-hour flight from London to New York. But I was like, oh, my God, I'll just stay here, you know, because it's like, you know, being on your couch and you could use the remote to change the channel on the TV.
Oh, boy.
And you get, you know, it's just an amazing way to travel, you know.
The only way to fly.
If ever we could get off of the oil thing and we could fly for free or whatever, that would just be the way to go. See, I want to bring back Zeppelins.
Well, that's one way to enjoy the ride.
I think that would be a really fabulous way to go, is to get helium. Is the problem with Zeppelins back in the day is that we refused to sell the Germans helium. So that's where all the bad press came from, the Hindenburg, because it caught on fire, because I guess they were using nitrogen. Does that make sense?
I don't recall what it
they
was.
They were using some...
It was flammable.
Flammable thing, and it crashed, and the whole thing caught on fire in New York. I think it... Wasn't it like some airstrip outside? Anyway, I can't remember. But there was these amazing photographs of this crash and burn of this amazing airship. And, I mean, I really think that... You know, and also cruising. Have you ever been on I've taken the QE2 once.
Oh, that would be marvelous. Getting there is half the fun.
Well, getting back, no, I went over to be a student in Paris at the American College in Paris, as it was called at the time. And on my way home, I think I'd acquired, 15 suitcases full of stuff. You know, I have a tendency just to acquire stuff. It doesn't even cost, just people give me things. So anyway, so they were going to charge me, I think, $60 a bag to send it back. And I was... You know, this is in 1979, so that would have meant, like, okay, let's say you send 10 back. That's $600 in baggage alone.
Mm.
So I was like, forget that. $900 if you count the other five. But anyway, so they had the student rate on the QE2. So for $400, you could have the whole week. That includes food, lodging, the whole thing. And you were supposed to have a roommate. Well, my roommate never showed up, so I had, you know, it was a tiny little cabin, but it was still my own, and... some other friends of mine that were on the QE2 as well. So, and also I'd been backpacking, you know, with a Eurail pass, so I was really fried. So the idea that all I had to do was lie around and eat, because that's basically what you do on cruises.
Yeah.
But it's so much nicer, because you know, I mean, still the North Atlantic is still, it's not like cruising through the Mediterranean. Mm. And we did have some heavy seas, and a lot of people got seasick.
Mm.
But nevertheless, you know, 5 days, it was just fabulous. You know, you just get a lot of rest, and you arrive in New York, and you just, you know, I was swimming in baggage. That was another hilarious story, is that the line to get the taxis when we arrived in New York City was, imagine a boat of, I can't remember how many people, let's say 1,000 people. They're all trying to get taxis at the same time. So the line was... probably, you know, 400 people or 300 people. I mean, it was just, and I come out with this huge cart full of these 15 suitcases.
Mm.
And this kind of sketchy guy walked up to me and goes, "You want a limo?" And this was when stretch limos were big in New York. They don't seem to have them as much anymore. But anyway, so this was a guy that was obviously driving someone around the city. And, you know, like, let's say you drop someone off at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then you come and pick them up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so that...
He got a lag time.
He had lag time, and he would rent himself out, right? So I said, well, how much would you charge? And he said, $25, which was a pretty good price, you know, considering how much luggage I had. So we literally filled up this entire stretch limo with all my bags.
Whoa,
and
lucky
cut,
time.
And cut through this line of 100 people.
Oh.
And just went straight... to the bus station where I put it all, you know, in storage until I could figure out what the hell to do with it all.
You must have had good karma on that.
Sometimes it works in my favor.
You know, when you travel on the QE2 or something like that, or in first class, you realize that...
No, it wasn't first class I was traveling up, but go ahead.
Oh, but you were bumped up. you realize that it's a metaphor for life, perhaps, because the journey itself is the important thing, not just the destination. I used to live in New York and in Philadelphia, gone part of the rat race, fast-paced life. But when I went down to the South and visited my family, I would realize that nobody was in a hurry.
Right.
And I've come to realize that nobody was in a hurry where I visited them, because they already were where they wanted to be. Ram Dass tells us that that we want to be here now,
but that,
in the present.
I think that's a confusing passivity with enlightenment.
I did make a segue there.
I would say that you can be here now and be multitasking like you can't imagine. In fact, when you're multitasking like that, you have to be so present. You know, for example, you know, like working in the movie business, I have to be very present in order to anticipate that window of opportunity that I have to get my job done in between all the other departments that are trying to get their job done.
Yes.
And trying to cost the company as least amount of time or money as I can.
Yes.
You know, because you do not want to be on the hot seat and having a set full of 90 people watching you do your job. It's very nerve-wracking.
And waiting for you to get done meditating?
No. Well, no, but the interesting thing is that what I find interesting is that you become, it's a hyper sense of reality
mm-hmm.
when you are really present and focused on what you're doing. So what's interesting to me is that they've been paying me to be here now since, I don't know, 86, when I first got into the business. And I mean, before then I was doing it for free, but once they started paying me, that's what's so interesting about money, is that, okay, I worked on a few free projects for some graduate students at NYU, and then I did my first feature in 86, summer of 86, Sweet Lorraine, and when I came back and worked for those same people again, my skill level had just ramped up exponentially. And so when I came back, you just can't teach this in film school. You know, it's sort of like business school. You know, having your own business teaches you so much more than any kind of business theory.
Absolutely.
I mean, I had a little company in L.A., a lighting company. You like this. Ego Lighting, we're the best, just ask us. Right? That was our motto.
You had T-shirts with that on there, didn't
T-shirts,
you?
T-shirts, exactly. And then we had our phone number underneath. And but having a business where there's money on the line and skin in the game, it really, you understand how business works.
Indeed.
You know, and whether it's worth getting the, because like we sort of had it as a tax writer for a long time, and then we wanted to borrow some money to, you know, buy some lights. And we realized that we had to show a profit on our tax return, which we would have to pay tax on in order to borrow money to expand. So it was easier to ask my brother for money and put in a little of my working capital than it was to show a profit, pay taxes on it, and then we would be able to borrow money from, you know, a lender who might not be sympathetic if you weren't able to pay it back in a timely fashion.
Yes.
And then you get penalties and all that kind of stuff, and interest on top of that.
There's no substitute for experience. These are the things you find out along the way.
Right. But and then another thing was is that we figured out there's a perfect model for rentals in our business, and that we figured out that if you could pay for whatever you were buying with 20 days of rental, then it was worth buying. Otherwise, you would just subrent it. Like for example, if a light cost $1,000 and you could rent it for, I don't know, you know, $20 a day. There was a certain formula. We came out with a 20-day formula that if you could pay it off within 20 days, then it was worth purchasing. Because otherwise, you could just sub-rent it. Because if it was sort of a specialty item, particularly, you know, and a high-cost specialty. Like, we never bought a truck, for example. Because the truck, you don't actually get a lot. Like, let's say the truck costs $60,000. Well, there's no way that you can rent it for whatever the equivalent of 20 days rental. It was just sort of an absorbed cost because there's also insurance and, you know, all kinds of maintenance that goes on with having a truck. So we could rent a truck for $1,000 a week and just build out the shelves And then, because each job would have different size trucks, you know, so that you never knew what kind of job was coming at you. So to have this, you know, ticking time bomb, you know, kind of in your business model of something that you weren't guaranteed, you know, that it was going to work all the time.
Yes.
So people just couldn't understand. And then also you would constantly get a new truck so that, you know, yeah. And it wasn't our responsibility to maintain it.
There you are. That's brains over brawn. I had on the show before, Futurist Jim Hill was talking about resource sharing. And if you needed a sedan to get to work, you needed a station wagon because you're going to take your kids in different places, you would own both of those cars. But there are now communities that are doing community cars.
Zip cars.
Yeah, thank you very much. Zip cars. And so it becomes a resource. And I think that's a parallel a little
they
bit.
They have
of
zip bikes, too.
Yeah, there you go. And it's not only in automobiles, but it's in other things, and there's even job sharing and so forth. So then rather than just bulking up on material acquisition, which is a physical approach, you're using your head to have virtual resources rather
right.
than fixed. Brains over brawn.
So we've got 5 minutes to save the world. What should we focus on?
Well, I don't know. I think we'll just take the whole planet at a time rather than continent by continent. After all, we've only got 5 minutes, down to three, actually. So... really, what is the message that you would like to pass on to people based on your experience? You've had such a rich experience, such a rich history. We barely touched the surface.
Well, actually, you know, in the book of, you know, The Saga of the Dalai Lama, it sounds funny, but I was most interested in how to be happy. I mean, I think...
Very important.
The pursuit of happiness is something that most people end up falling short. And so... I was thinking that the spiritual world would be the panacea to my problems. But I found that even if you reach enlightenment, which I sort of reached the state, you can still get a spiritual hangover. So the point being is, how do you be here now and not resist what's happening?
Hmm.
And so instead of happiness per se, it's more of a place of acceptance and non-resistance to what actually is happening, to as opposed to what you wish would be happening.
So if you're finding it mutually exclusive, maybe you haven't really found the way.
No, it's not mutually exclusive. I think that my destination is different.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of the pursuit of happiness, it's more like the pursuit of non-resistance.
Interesting.
You know, the pursuit of acceptance. And trying to figure out... how to balance all these crazy energies that you encounter and that try to throw you off your center. And instead of worrying about being thrown off center, it's just how to rock back, you know, and how to just stay more grounded and peaceful no matter what happens.
I think that, therein lies elements of wisdom itself, and just in that concept.
I mean, the peace, the path of all understanding is a very interesting concept, and it's a reality, but not always.
Some things you make happen, some things you let happen, and may you have the wisdom to understand the difference between the two.
But that's still making. It's more that accepting what is, not that you're not going to try to change it and affect it, but we get so... I mean, this is kind of what movies do, is they just edit out all the boring bits.
Yes.
But the thing is that how to live life so that every moment is not boring, but...
That's a key. John Lennon said that life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Right. So, I mean, this is what we've got, so you just have to deal with whatever the hand, you know, the hand you're dealt.
Yes, you do. And to be centered, Eckhart Tolle said that silence is the language in which God speaks, and everything else is a bad translation. If we can find that silence within ourselves, if we can find our centering point where we don't have to be reactive all the time, but then just in a sense of being, there's a balance between being and doing. And that's really a point of philosophy that's been touched on actually for centuries, I believe.
I think that's a nice place to end.
I think it is, too. Molly Cheshire, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us a little bit about your observations of world travel, your perceptions on American history, which I think are very good perceptions. And your site is going to be available, themollylama.com, and later this month, folks, you can go to themollylama.com, looking forward to premiering on the web in just a few weeks. and you'll be able to download some introductory free chapters of her book, The Saga of the Dalai Lama. I highly recommend you find it out because she has a lot of things to share with the rest of us based on travels and experiences that many of us only read about. So read about it in her works at themalilama.com. Thank you for listening to the Cycles of Change radio program. I'm your host, David Katzmeyer, signing out for tonight.